And I remember sitting on the dock, still finishing, like just finished my race, like sitting on the dock with my legs still in my canoe, just like contemplating life. And I remember, like it was yesterday, that I decided, like, either I'm going to quit or I'm going to get better, because this is no fun. Spending all the time training and still not doing well. And so the interesting thing is that my belief was that I was training hard. And when I had that experience, I realized, okay, obviously I'm not doing something right. And I was hell bent on, like, the next time that there's going to be no question. Like, if I win, they can't stop me from going to the Olympics.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Evolution of Leaders podcast. My name is Darwin Lee, and I am a coach and speaker. I'm the founder of the Evolution of Leaders. On this podcast, I'm interested in exploring the traits, habits, or behaviors that set apart elite performers through their stories and in their own words. You're in for a treat today as I interview Gavin Maxwell, longtime member of the Canadian National Canoe Team, competed in Hineal C1 Canoe in 1996 at the Atlanta Olympics, 12-time world champion in Dragon Boat, 37-time national champion in sprint canoe racing. He's now a chiropractor at Island Optimal in Nanaimo. Gavin was a fascinating talk on so many levels, so many great stories. But what resonated with me the most is that he wasn't so different from you and me. He's open about some of the challenges facing world-class athletes. And my favorite were the two moments when he doesn't meet his goals in deciding to be successful. It's a decision, it's a choice as a young athlete to be successful. And again, deciding to do what he could to make the Olympic team, just such a story of courage and sacrifice and trusting in himself. I hope you enjoy this interview.
Gavin, I was wondering if you could just do a kind of 1 minute intro in your own words of your athletic or your career.
Sure. I mean, I think my background in sport was like a lot of kids growing up. I grew up in Oakville, Ontario, and played soccer and football and basketball and all that sort of stuff. But in the 90 or the 84 Olympic Games, Larry Kane won gold and silver at those Olympics, and he's from Oakville. And I had started paddling that summer, and I think that was a big draw for me to get into paddling. And I started paddling then. I think I was between grade 7 and 8, so probably 13 years old. The neat part about Larry is that the best guys in Canada would come and train in Oakville at my canoe club. So I got to see the top guys. You know, my sort of progression through sport wasn't immediate, but it was neat to have these guys around. So that's how I started paddling. But I was always like one of these kids that watched a wide world of sports, you know, on ABC every Saturday and Sunday, and just loved watching anything. And I wanted to, whatever was on TV, I wanted to be that, whether it was like a gymnast or a skater or a, you know, a ski jumper. I wanted to be one of those guys. So I know it stemmed from me as a young kid that I wanted to be good at something, but I wasn't really good at anything. I was decent at stuff. So that was how I started as an athlete. And then the paddling just sort of evolved. And I think a large part was because I had a lot of good role models and a lot of, you know, a really good program at Oakville. You know, Oakville has had, you know, probably, I think, at least one athlete on the Canadian Olympic team ever since probably 1984 or earlier, all the way through up till now. So, yeah.
Definitely iconic as far as Canadian clubs go. And you're growing up and you're training as a canoe racer, and you get into C1. And so for those that are listening might not know, C1, it's a Hineal canoe. One leg up and one leg down. And basically it's get from start to finish as fast as possible. Do you think you'd be an Olympian?
I don't think so. I mean, like I said just a bit earlier here, that I always wanted to be an athlete. I wanted to be good, but it was an evolution for sure. When I started paddling, I was actually really terrible at it. As you said, like C1 paddling is actually quite difficult even just to stay in them, because you're kneeling on one knee and you paddle on the same side. So for the first year and a half or 2 years, I was in the creek more than I was in the boat. And to most people, you would think that, you know, I wasn't good at it, so maybe I would have stopped and done something else, but I just loved it. And even in the first couple of races that I was, when I was good enough to race, I'd fall out of the boat during the middle of the race. And, And so like I was, you know, there's obviously some stubbornness there. I enjoyed being outside. There were a lot of good young, you know, kids, like friends of mine that paddled. But it was, you know, probably when I was 17, I was playing at a club volleyball level. So just I was going to like, you know, Ontario provincial team tryouts for volleyball, but I wasn't making it. But like I was decent. And I was also second in Canada for my age in 500 C1, so the 500 meter race. So I was good at both, but not really good at either. And then that's when I determined, okay, I'm going to have to stop. I have to choose one. And I chose paddling. And then that was it. Like I was doing basically the one sport. And, I stuck with it. And I wanted to be good. I wouldn't say like my goal was the Olympics, but it did get there as I improved. Now, I was actually not a good like junior athlete. So under 18, 19, I never made the junior teams to go to junior worlds. I was actually one of the slowest people in my age, which also begged the question of why I continued doing it. Cause I would thought I was training hard and I would go there and get my doors blown every time, come like eighth or ninth in the final and, you know, shaking my head. So those days when I was 17, 18, they would have been there's no way. I was thinking that there was 30 guys in Canada, maybe more, that were better than I was. So the idea of going to the Olympics was pretty fleeting, you know?
Wow. Okay. And we'll get to the 96 Olympic in a moment here, but you get faster and you start winning, you know, nationals. Now you missed the 92 Olympics by one spot.
Yes.
And you're racing at the 96 Olympics.
Yeah. What's funny, I actually never won a race until I was 19. I was making provincial teams and doing well at nationals, like coming second and third. Now, when I was what they call first year junior, so when you're like over 18, I won the first race of the year, and then I won every other race that year. Now, I didn't win like the trials when I was with the top guys, but in my age category, for some reason that summer I learned how to win. And I won nationals. And at the time I had like the Canadian national record, which has been decimated since. But, you know, I learned that summer how to win. And then the next year I raced in C2 at the trials with a guy named Steve Giles, who's like a Canadian legend or a world legend of paddling. And we won the C2 1,000 meters. So he was 17 and I was 19 or just turned 19. And that was pretty unheard of to win the senior trials at that age. So we went to Europe and raced. And so that was sort of my first foray into international racing. I never had an opportunity to race when I was 16, 17, 18, where most athletes in our sport have that. And I didn't. So I was a late bloomer, I guess is the point.
Wow. Okay. The obvious question then is what habit or behavior, what did you change that allowed you to excel? You're finishing eighth, ninth, and then you're finishing on the podium.
Yeah, I think it was a moment that, so we used to have our trials always at the Montreal Olympic Basin. And it was one summer that I had decided, or I'd thought, that I trained really hard. And this is the year I was going to go and make some noise at the trials, you know, and whatever that means, come top to make it to Europe. And now, I'm still young, but 18, 19, but I'm still in that time. And I must have been 18 because it was the year before. And I got killed. I was like last in, I think I didn't make the final. I was like one of the last guys in the semifinal. And I remember sitting on the dock, still finishing, like just finished my race, like sitting on the dock with my legs still on my canoe, just like contemplating life. And I remember like it was yesterday that I decided like either I'm going to quit or I'm going to get better. Because this is no fun, spending all the time training and still not doing well. And so the interesting thing is that my belief was that I was training hard. And when I had that experience, I realized, okay, obviously I'm not doing something right. And then I started actually looking at what guys like Larry Kane and other guys at our club were doing. And I wasn't doing what they were doing. So my idea of hard work and what was actually hard work were not the same. You know, so I had this sort of false ceiling of hard work. And I can tell you that I probably went through that false ceiling four or five or six times in my evolution as an athlete, because you know what I mean? You think you're working hard and you're not. And so, but it comes down to that one recollection of a race that I just got sick and tired of being, of getting beaten. It just wasn't fun.
Wow. Really, you learned hard lessons in work ethic, but it's interesting. You're saying the false ceilings multiple times. So you're working incredibly hard and then you realize you can work even harder.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, even like the sacrifices you make, when it came down to it, I didn't go to parties. I didn't drink. I didn't do birthday dinners with friends because it would impact my training. And that's what it took to be good, is like absolute like commitment and dedication. And then it was also a matter of just putting in the work every day, just good, bad, indifferent, just do the work, and things will improve. And they inevitably did. And I think it was a matter of just believing in the process, as opposed to, work hard for a couple of weeks and expect big changes. And like nothing works that way. And it just took me a long time. But I think, as people are all fairly impatient, whether it comes to, losing weight, getting stronger, whatever, getting to a new habit, they never happen fast enough. and so that was a big lesson, just to keep doing what I'm doing, believe in my program, believe in my coach, and things will actually work out. And that's what happened.
Things will work out, believe in your coach, your training. So from your perspective, what role did coaching play in helping you in your career? And you've done both. You've been both a paddler and a coach, but as an athlete, or as a person who guides athletes, what role does a coach play?
A coach is a role model. It's a sounding board, being open to listen to the athlete. It's also giving guidance to the athletes, whether it's even just from like programming, to race preparation days. In my experience, an athlete has to show confidence. The athlete can believe in them, and that we're doing the right thing. And the neat part is like when I've coached, I try to think about what worked for me as an athlete. Not that it's going to work for everybody, but for me, it worked. And so, I know it's tough. Like it's tough to say exactly what it was. But I also had like Larry Kane, who was also my training partner for probably 10 or 12 years. He was also a lot of my coach as well. So we would, although we were competitors, we would still help each other, so that was an interesting dynamic as well.
Cycling back to the Olympics then, you make the team, and it's been a 4-year wait, kind of from narrowly missing to finally making the team. What did that teach you during that time? Is that when you learned some of these things you're talking about, confidence, humility, dignity, or were there other lessons?
Yeah, I think so. I think I've learned those through my, parents and stuff as well, and being around good people. But I tell you, in the 92 Olympic Games, like I wouldn't have made the team as a paddler. I would have made the team as a spare. So I would never have raced. But what happened was there were, in canoe, you're either a left-sided paddler or a right-sided paddler, like we do in dragon boating. And so there was the left spare I had beaten by 15 seconds at the trials, and the right spare, he beat me in 500. I beat him in 1,000, but he raced in C2 with another guy that beat us. So his point totals were higher than me. So like you could argue that we were very similar, but he got the nod to the team and I didn't. And the two guys that made the team, I don't begrudge them anything, but it was kind of hard to take when I know I was literally about 100 meters faster than one guy going to the Olympics. So it was, in hindsight, it was the best thing that happened to me, because those two guys who are still good friends of mine, I have hold no grudges against them, they retired the year after or 2 years after the games. And I was hell bent on like the next time that we were, don't think there's going to be no question. Like if I win, they can't stop me from going to the Olympics. So in the 92 season, like I was coming second and third and fourth, right? So there's guys better than me, but if you win, they can't take it from you. And so I basically was like, I'm going to work my butt off for the next 4 years, and I'm going to go to the trials and I'm going to win. And it was, yes, it was a very much a 4 year evolution, if you will, or a trial and error of learning how to do that. Now, as an athlete, when I was confident, I was almost unbeatable. But if I had any sort of sense of doubt, I was very, very, very fragile as an athlete. And I remember some of my coaches and some of my other athletes saying that to me, like, when you're on, like, you're incredible. And so that was something that I never quite mastered as an athlete, is to be able to have the proper mindset and go out there and do my best. And so that's always been a challenge of mine. And I think just to finish that point, like, when people say, do you think, you know, you could have done better at the games or won, you know, and the funny thing is I never dreamt that I'd be world champion. And that doesn't mean that I could have been, but I know that I never was, because I never believed I could. Do you know what I mean? And then I think that's something that maybe in hindsight, if I thought, you know, I can win the worlds, then maybe I could have got there. But I didn't even give myself a chance, like, from a mental standpoint, that I wasn't good enough. But the thing is that my times were, I was good enough. You know, I was in the top 10 many years. So this, and I'm within a couple seconds of winning. And, you know, it's funny. You look back and say, what if I had a different mindset or was able to believe in myself more? You know, I certainly think I had the tools for it. There wasn't many guys my size. And I was pretty fit and all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of funny looking back.
If you were that close to making it and yet, you know, weren't selected for the team, I would have thought that, you know, when you talk about confidence and having doubt, I would have thought that making the team would have given you a lot of confidence. And then seeing as in your own performance, as you got faster and faster, that would have really fed you. But it's still, you still dealt with doubts, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, no, I did. I mean, I got very good at being good. You know, like I remember talking to some guys sort of a couple of years after we retired, and, you know, it just sort of, it came up in conversations. Like, we always knew that you would be good at trials. Like, you're always someone that would be there, which was neat, because you don't really know what other people think about you. And I would always, like, in those years from like 94 to 99, I was always in the top two or three. So that wasn't the problem. The problem came is sort of when I started racing internationally. And I think part of my sort of thinking was that I didn't really have a whole lot of kicks at the can racing C1 at the Worlds and at international races, because I wasn't a good junior. And when I started racing for Canada, I raced a lot of two-man boats and four-man boats, a lot of like C4. Which is a great boat, but you're still like, you're with three other guys and you're not by yourself. And, you know, I used to see like the Russian guys and, you know, I think they were robots. You know, we used to sit and watch, you know, VHS video of all these guys racing. And so for me to go and see them in the flesh when we go to Europe, like, they're almost like superheroes to me. And it took me a little while to be able to sort of realize these guys put their pants on one leg at a time, like I do. And I think that even in itself, that sort of idea is like, hey, that's the Russian guy. That's the guy that I've been watching on video for 6-7 years. That's the German guy. That's the Polish guy. That's the Hungarian guy. You know, it was a real obstacle to my success, because I literally would make that, you know, it got in my own way, so to speak, you know.
That's interesting, because as we were talking offline, you were saying that sometimes people don't talk to you at festivals. And I wonder if sometimes they don't realize you put your pants on one leg at a time, the same as they do.
Yeah, that's possible. That is very possible, I guess. Yeah. No, and it's funny, right? Because we were talking about that. It's like, yeah, people are people. And, you know, one of the neat things is we used to have the Canadian team actually sponsored the Russian athletes to come to our training camp in Florida in the early 90s, I think 91 or 92-ish. Yeah. And so that was really neat to actually, we were living with these guys and going in vans to the, you know, all you can eat buffets for dinner and stuff when I was like 18, 19, and see these guys. And you realize they're just like you, you know, they're, they're just like you. They get tired, and that was a big step for me. But I guess the whole idea of like going over to Europe and, you know, being the guy to race for Canada, like it was a lot for me. And I don't know if too many athletes are really successful right off the gate at racing internationally or at the highest level. I think for most of us, it takes a bit of time to get comfortable and believe in yourself, you know, and I definitely believe that near the end of my career, I was able to do that. So my last competitive year, I made the final at Duisburg, which is probably one of the biggest World Cup races that we have. And that one has two entries per country versus one entry per country at the world. So you could argue that Duisburg is actually more competitive than the world because you have like two Germans and two Hungarians.
Oh,
and two,
okay. Yeah.
Right. So you get, and because, you know, in Hungary, you probably get five or six guys who could make the final, you know, but they only one guy gets the race. So some of these World Cup races are actually more competitive because you just have some really, really strong countries that guys don't ever get a chance to race. So I was able to make the final there. So I finished ninth, but for me, that was pretty good. I was like, hey, I'm actually in the top 10 in the world.
Wow, that's top 10 in the world is phenomenal.
Yeah. And it was funny too, because it was those years when I got a bit older that I was able to be a little bit more, have more perspective in a sense that in my earlier years of going to Europe, I used to sit in the hotel room, rest, go over my race plan, do visualizations, do all the things that I thought was important to race well. But I almost made it too much. It was too much of what I wanted to do. And I was always pretty tight about it, you know, and it was kind of holding, you know, holding that proverbial like bird too tightly in your hands. Like I wanted it so much that I sort of got my own way. And when I got older, I started to like take walks at wherever the city were. I needed to go to a pub and have a drink or have a pop or something like that and just talk to a local and just sort of understand it, that I was very lucky to be in Europe and have these opportunities. And that sort of realization that paddling isn't everything and that if I'm more balanced in my approach, that I actually could race better. And I did. And it was one of those things where hindsight, you know, is 20/20. It was like, if I knew then what I know now, it could have been a bit different. But I think that's all about growing and evolving as an athlete and a person.
Wow, so you really grew into it. So you mentioned a few things there, and I want to explore that a little bit. You mentioned, you know, about kind of self-reflection and talking earlier about journaling and kind of getting a different perspective. And so as a coach then, when you're leading athletes through this, maybe that don't have the experiences that you do, where do some of these things fit in and visualizations and other things you mentioned?
Yeah, Now, so I think from a coaching perspective, like, and an athlete perspective, and those, the two sides of that, the working hard is the easy part, right? Like putting your shoes on, getting out of the house and going for a run, like that's easy. You just get up and do it, right? Doing the weights, going to practice, learning how to paddle. Like, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's doable, right? And I always talk about this idea that fitness and technical ability and time in the boat, that's not a finite amount, right? We don't share a finite amount amongst a team. Like it's an infinite amount of fitness and technical ability and time in the boat. So that stuff you can do fairly easily, right? If you can buy that argument. But the other part, like the mental side, the preparation, the visualization, the confidence, the right mindset is something that's very much underrated in sport. And certainly in I've seen in dragon boating. Right, because there's a lot of teams that we've maybe paddled on or that I've coached over the years that are very good, but they never really race to their potential when it comes to time to shine. And that's the part where I felt like that's where I can really sort of add value to them. So I do talk about visualization, I do talk about journaling. I want them to write their workouts down, and not only what they did, but how they felt. And if they had a good workout, what was the mindset? What were they? Were they happy? Were they sad? Were they listening to music? Were they, you know, writing those down? And then after a certain amount of time, 6 months, a year, 2 years, you can review that and really start to understand that this is the mindset I need to be to do my best. And this is a mindset that I don't want to be, because I know if I'm in that mindset that I don't do my best. And, you know, I profess to say that if, you know, you don't, never want to go to a race and hope that you will perform well. You want to make sure you perform well. And the only way to do that is to understand yourself as an athlete, right? And approach your training as you would approach a race. So athletes that train lazily or don't bring everything to every effort or what's demanded in the effort, is they'll bring that at race day. You know, so if you want to work hard and perform well, you have to do that in practice. And if you learn yourself as an athlete in practice, you can basically try to dial that in and then bring that to race day. And I think that's the biggest thing I learned as an athlete. And the biggest thing that I've learned as a coach, certainly at the highest level, the high performance level, because, you know, like I was saying before, like, you know, you're not going to go to a lot of races and be fitter than the next high performance team, but you're going to have to find a way to beat them on that day.
This reminds me of a quote that is out there that you stated was, I didn't make much money doing it, so it wasn't about the money. It was about the love of the pursuit of excellence. What is, Gavin, the pursuit of excellence?
I believe it's how you approach every day in your life and as your life as an athlete. So doing your best, you know, preparing well for training. Let's say, for example, like if training is at 6:30, I don't want my athlete showing up at 6:29 or 6:31. I want them showing up at 6:05 so they can get ready and prepare and be their best to go at 6:30. So that is a way of excellence, right? I want them to be able to put their troubles or their stresses of the day, whether it's work or school or family, put that in their back pocket for the time that they're training, and so they can get the most out of it. Like, it's all about having quality in your efforts as much as it's doing the effort. So I contend that, you know, if you're going to train, let's say 8 times during a week and you bring 5 good efforts out of the 8, then you're missing 3. And if your counterpart is bringing 7 or 8 good efforts, you start adding that 5 up times 5, it's 25 versus 5 times 8, which is 40. You know, you're down in competing against the next team. So for me, it's about consistency, quality, you know, and then further to that, like also echoing good qualities of a person, you know, are you able to work, go to school and be an athlete and also be a person you can be, people can stand to be around, you know, that they're not, you're not rude or arrogant or too tired to be able to you know, not lose their cool in certain situations, you know? So for me, the pursuit of excellence is how we approach our life in this instance, how we approach our life as an athlete, you know, and to pursue those goals that we've talked about, which is excellence, whether it's winning or whatever you deem the goal that season, which is different for every team and at every level. So yeah, that's what I believe. I mean, I believe excellence stems from good process and good quality in your process.
That's a fascinating answer. And right now on Netflix, there's a well-known documentary that's airing, you know, whenever listeners might be hearing this, but it's called The Last Dance, about the last season of the Chicago Bulls. And Michael Jordan is not portrayed, not known, maybe as someone who is nice or someone that others want to be around all the time. You're saying, it seems to be somewhat in contrast, which is very interesting. The pursuit of excellence is not just excellence in sport. It seems to me what you're saying is the pursuit of excellence as a human.
Yeah, no, I would think so. But I also can understand, you know, where Michael Jordan is coming from, because I've been watching that show as well. And so I would preface that by, like, when it's time to compete, like, that's different. So I tell my guys, like, this is war. When we get out there and we turn around, we go down, like, it's be or kill or be killed from a metaphorical standpoint, you know. But once the race is over, once you hit the finish line, then you respect your, you should be, like, in our community in dragon boating, we're talking about that. Like, we all know each other, we're friends, but when we're racing, no, we're not friends. Right. So for me, it's a matter of, okay, when do you turn on that killer mentality? Like Michael Jordan does. He seemed like he had it everywhere, right? Didn't want to lose in anything. And I would contest that a guy like Michael Jordan, who is probably the pinnacle of athlete of any time, any sport, had that in droves, right? And I've been around enough athletes that have won Olympic medals, and they have that as well. And I don't know if I have that level of it, because I recall when I would look at some guys that had that, and I would see them, and I'm like, if I have to be like them to be the best in the world, then I don't want, you know what I mean? Like, it was almost too much for me in a sense. Wow. And I remember that as a young athlete too. So that could be part of the reason why I wasn't world champion, that I didn't choose to have that mentality, or I didn't possess that mentality. Because I recall before the Michael Jordan thing came out, Michael Jordan said, people are not going to like me after, or going to hate me, I think he even said, after watching this. Mm-hmm. You know, and when I see it, I'm like, this doesn't surprise me. And it's probably a lot of people, doesn't surprise them. This is who he was, because it almost takes that sort of mentality to be who he was, to be like, you know, head and shoulders above the best players in the world. Like, you've got to be a little bit different. I mean, I think.
Yeah.
There's two sides to that. I guess to answer your question is that, and I'm guilty of it. I'd be the first one to say that there are times after race that I'd be mad still, and I'd say things, and because I'm riled up, like I'm really competitive, and I have to come down, and I'll go back to the person and apologize, because I'm still in that sort of warrior mentality. And because I think that's what it took for me to be good, is that, and even in that saying, Michael Jordan in the last couple episodes is talking about somebody made it personal with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And he said, okay, once you make it personal, it's over. And the funny thing is, I had one of my athletes email me or text me this week and said, that reminds me of what you used to say. So when someone makes it, so I always say, if you make it personal with me, I will kill you. Like, competitively. I will, because, right, there's one thing about being sportsmanlike, but as soon as you make it personal, then it's like, okay, that gets me going. And it was funny because it resonated with me, but it was neat that it resonated with other people that had been around me too, you know.
You got to film a documentary called The Last Boat or something, hey?
Exactly.
And so some of the names, what are some of the names of the people you couldn't stand to be like? I'm joking. We're not going there.
No, but it's not even that. It's not even that, you know, like I respect them, but you see, and I think we all see that in our lives somewhere with people who are, you know, really, really good at something. And then you say, well, you know, they're a little bit off, you know, maybe in a good way, maybe like they're committed to a certain, the crazy amount, or, you know, they lack balance. Let's say, like, I was always like, if I have to be, have no friends to be a world champion, then, well, I don't want to be a world champion, because like, how fun would it be to have that sort of those accolades and have no one to share it with, for example.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but in the same way, like a lot of those things, the guys that I would, if it comes to mind, a lot of those things I respected, absolutely. And a lot of the things I learned from, but there are certain things that I just, A, either wasn't capable of, I didn't have in my sort of DNA, or I just didn't choose to do that because, you know, it wasn't that important. Because, like, the way I look at it is that, you know, if I had won an Olympic Games or two Olympic Game medals or world championships, I'd be sitting in my living room right now talking to you, and you people, as many people that know who I am in the world would know the same now. You know, canoeing isn't a big sport. So it wasn't that big of a deal to be world champion, you know.
Mm-hmm. You were a competitive athlete, an elite athlete, truly elite. And now you work with lots of talented, hardworking paddlers, perhaps not as gifted as you were, maybe not as at the same level. So as you're working as a coach with these types of athletes, what does a successful approach look like?
So the funny thing is that there are athletes that I've coached and presently coach who are way more talented than I was. Like, The dragon boat athlete in Canada now are insanely talented, insanely committed. And it's awesome, actually. They're guys that'll do stuff that I could never do. So that's one thing I wanted to say first is that, and gals too, don't get me wrong. Like some stuff that will just, it'll just make you like shake your head at some of the things these guys can do and gals can do. But my approach is I approach them. And my workouts and programming is like I did, right? I treat them like they're Olympic athletes and I expect them to bring that effort. I don't expect them to bring the results right away to the training or even maybe the intensity or the volume in the beginning, right? So if I can think back to the team I'm coaching now, which is NDRC, I've been with them 8 or 9 years, I think 8 or 9 year. So a while now. And these guys and gals have been doing my training for that many years. And so their ability to deal with that volume is it's normal for them now. You know, when I first came on, they're like, wow, this is a lot, you know? And I'm like, yep, it's a lot. And there would be even things like technically that the nuances of the technique that I didn't actually bring on to the team for a couple of 2 or 3 years until they were like ready for it from a developmental standpoint, if that makes sense. And so that part, so that the hard working part, so that ability to work hard and to do good efforts day in, day out, you know, keep, and I use this adage of putting your pennies in the piggy bank. So you just keep putting the money in so that when it's time to withdraw it, that you have the money in the bank. So that's the training part. But you also have to learn to train hard. You have to have the capacity to learn hard or to work hard. And then even the technical part. I mean, there's even things now, this is like I said, 8 or 9 years into it, that I can bring to them because they're experienced enough to know what I'm talking about. You know, like if I think about, you know, teaching a beginning paddler how to hold the paddle, like that's very different than how to accelerate the blade, you know, turn the blade out at the end to get a little bit more, you know, water on the blade, like different things that are a little bit more advanced that make sense at a different level. So the approach is always like at the highest level, but it's always catered to the level of the athlete I'm dealing with at the time. So that makes sense.
Yeah. So it's steps. Pennies and
steps. And of course you're going to have different athletes at different levels of different steps on that staircase, if you will, right? And so my expectation for some of the people that are higher up on that stairs is different than the ones that are lower down. It's, you know what I mean, it's not that I expect the same dedication and commitment and work ethic, but I may not expect the same amount of result or performance or number of reps, or because they're at a different point. And so that's an interesting thing when it comes to dragon boating, when you have upwards of 30 athletes. And in our case, we have over 50 athletes on our team. So you're going to have a wide variety of levels of talent, of experience, of commitment, you know, that all have to be catered to. And that's a challenge.
That's amazing. Gavin Maxwell, this has been a pleasure. So I'm just going to wrap things up, stay on the line. Really want to thank you for your time, though. This was so good. Lots of great information.
And there you have it. Interview with Gavin Maxwell. Imagine being as fast or faster than two guys who made the Olympic team and not going. You could be better, you could be better. And he chose to be better. Didn't play the victim card, no anger towards his two teammates, and he just decided to win. Just so amazing. I love how he was faced with finishing last in his heat, and in an honest moment with himself, realizes he just needed to change something, and had some great teammates and training partners and great coaches along the way. Just so good. Coaching is like that. Coaches help us to overcome some of our barriers or fears, some of the things that hold us back, and they work with us to overcome. I am a coach and speaker, and I help people get promoted in their career and business and in life. Please reach out if you would like to talk. I'm at evolutionofleaders.com. And by the way, check out the other video with Gavin that where I interview and we talk about the zone. It's just such good stuff, such a fountain of wisdom. So grateful. And if you enjoyed this video channel, please like and subscribe. Thank you so very much. It does make a difference. And remember, like Gavin says, believe in my program, believe in my coach. Have a good one. Get 1% better. Take care.